Okay, so on the first name on the book is Stan. I'm going to let him start. And we have a broken microphone, too. My name is Cecil. I'm an alcoholic. Start the meeting with a moment of silence for 75 years and for all those that are still suffering. Thank you. Now for the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Stanley. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's September 30th, 2002. My home group is Old Farts that meet at the Edit Club. And one of the AA secrets is if you don't drink and you don't die, you got a good chance of becoming an old fart. So don't drink and don't die. I also go to the Primary Purpose Club, Bottoms Up Group, and Recovery Hour. And also member of the Native American group number one at the Denver Indian Family Resource Center. We meet there on Thursday nights at 6 o'clock. And I feel very overwhelmed right now and full of emotion. A lot of good people here that I know that have helped me along my road in recovery in AA. And I feel very blessed to be here and alive and sober today, you know, and to be able to stand up here and look the world in the eye, you know, because for the longest time I felt guilt, shame, regret, and remorse, you know, and I ran on fear and anger and hatred, and that fueled my drinking for the longest time. And I thank God that I lived through all that I lived through and that I'm here today. And, you know, my story and my people's story is a long one, and I don't really have time to tell that all. You know, I'm descended from a Henasado Indian from the Abiquiu Pueblo in New Mexico, and there was a slave trade in New Mexico. There was this slave market in Taos, New Mexico, and that's where I'm descended from, is that slave trade. So I'm a minority within a minority, you know, and I really felt... all my life, I really couldn't find acceptance anywhere, you know, in any group of people. But when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I started going to the Edit Club where the old farts meet, and I was pretty tore up, you know. I used to say I was tore up from the floor up, needing a checkup from the neck up, you know. And I'd come in there and I would cry, you know. I couldn't speak without crying. And those people there, they would give me hugs, and they kept telling me, come back. And at that point in my drinking, not many people wanted me around. You know, my own family, my niece, you know, I love her to death. She's more like my little sister. She said, Uncle Stan, you know. I told her when I was 2 years sober, I says, you know, I'm doing good, ain't I great, and all this stuff. My head was pretty big. And she looked at me, she said, Uncle Stan, you're tolerable today. You know, that shrunk my head back down to about the size of a tennis ball. And she said, you know, when you used to come around, when you were drinking, sometimes we'd shut the lights off and pretend we weren't home, you know. And that hurt, you know. To be honest with you, you know, recovery for me has been very painful. It hasn't been an easy journey. But no matter what's happened, I found that I don't have to drink over anything that's going on in my life, you know. And I have real friends today. from around the country, Denver and like that, you know. And I can count on these people, you know. Dick, it's good to see you. I haven't seen you in a long time. And I can look around and I see a lot of faces, you know. And they told me to come up here and just talk like I was talking to my friends at a meeting, you know. And for me, you know, I have a lot of gratitude, you know. And they talk about gratitude a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I'm very grateful to be, you know, alive and sober and recovery, you know. I feel a little sad today. My daughter, she's 18 and a half. She's at home and she's sick and I'm not there to take care of her. But I told her, you know, I'm going to do my best to make her proud of me. I don't want anybody to ever see me drunk again. You know what I mean? Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me reclaim my manhood. You know what I mean? And I'm proud today, you know, to stand on my two feet, you know, wear this shirt, carry this bundle, carry this book, you know. I got a real good friend, Ray, in Denver. He's Chimawavy Paiute. And he tells me, Stanley, you know, keep the big book in one hand and keep a red road in the other hand, you know, like two shields. Stay in between them with protection like that, you know. And I try to walk like that these days, you know. I try to ask the Creator, you know, every morning for protection and care, you know. I seek protection and care with complete abandon every morning, and I thank the Creator at night, you know, for one day. Just one day of being successful, no matter what happens, if I'm sober that day, I'm successful, you know. And I don't know, you know, it's been a long journey, and a lot of things have happened, you know. I want to mention my sponsor, Airplane Bill and his wife, Pat. You know, I love you guys, and wherever you're at, we put your hand up, Bill and Pat, Keith and Glenda. You know, I love you guys. Thank you. Thank you, Bill. You know, he was one of the first guys that was there at those meetings that used to tell me to keep coming back and give me a hug and encouragement, you know. I'm kind of speechless right now, but I thank God, you know, that I'm here and alive and well, and no matter what happens, I don't have to drink. And, you know, back at home, you know, my friend Ray, I was talking to you about, we do sweat lodges every Sunday, and most people that come up to our sweat are in recovery, you know, and we talk about recovery and the higher power, you know, and that's our religion, you know. And when I got to AA, they told me that I could have the God of my own understanding, you know. And I had these spiritual ways already, you know. I grew up with them, and I seen my first Sundance when I was 18 years old in Fort Hall, Idaho, you know. I was drunk when I showed up there, but I knew there was something there, you know. I knew something in my heart, or something told me there was something there, you know. And we do that, you know. We try to do the best that we can, you know, with what we've been taught. And we try to have respect and act right and behave ourselves correctly, you know, around that fireplace, you know. I brought my pipe with me today and my feathers, you know, because so you guys know that what I'm telling you is the truth. You know, if you're a native person, you know what these feathers, pipe mean to us, you know. That I can't be up here lying to you, you know. They told me don't embellish my story. I told them I think my story is good enough the way it is. If you're living in the YMCA, selling your plasma for alcohol money and eating at the mission and thinking you're better than the other guy, I think I belong here, you know what I mean? So today I'm not eating at the mission and I'm not living at the Y, and I don't have to sell my plasma for alcohol. You know, that's that freedom from the bondage itself, so. Anyway, I'm supposed to speak for 20 minutes, and I don't have a watch. So I guess I'm running on Indian time. And That's good, Doug, you know, like that. You know. No pressure, you know. I was a little nervous, you know, but I feel really relaxed right now, and I feel good, you know. And, you know, I pick up a lot of teachings from a lot of Native people. And I know a woman, she's sitting in prison now, you know, a Diné woman, you know. She told me, she says, my mom used to tell us, hold each other in your prayers. You know, hold each other in your prayers. And she taught me that, you know, from inside a prison, you know. And I want to think about my my relatives, you know, in hospitals and prisons and jails and things like that right now. You know, our homeless people, you know, we got it rough out there. Life ain't easy, you know. There's not enough of us in recovery, you know, and I'd like to see more. And that's why I'm active in that group in Denver, Native American group number one. And we're going to start another one up when I get back in Denver at the Denver Indian Center. And I'm just going to keep doing what we do, you know, and try to keep my head tennis ball size, you know what I mean? My friend, he told me, he said, there's no wheels in AA, just spokes. You know, and I'm just happy to be a spoke and be up here and part of this thing. It's bigger than I am, you know, and I'll let Cecil take over. God bless you all. Thank you.
I'm Cecil, and I am an alcoholic. Took me a long time to get to that point of realizing I was an alcoholic. I mean, part of my story includes prison. I went on 7 trips to the penitentiary in California. Never thought I had a drinking problem. You know, take out the fact that every single time I've ever been arrested, I was under the influence of alcohol. Not a problem. But, you know, Brother Stan was sharing and talking about, you know, our Native peoples and this disease and how it affects our people. It takes me back to being in prison inside, because before I went to prison, I really didn't know who I was in many ways, because I knew I was Hopi. And it was my mom's tribe. And I hadn't really spent a lot of time around my traditional ways. We lived near the reservation, and there was a lot of drinking in the weekends. The bars would fill up with all the brothers and sisters coming in to spend their paychecks. And I remember walking around this town, this small town in Arizona, Winslow, and seeing my brothers and sisters laying on the sidewalks, you know, in the following morning. And, you know, and so that formed a picture on my mind of what alcoholic was, you know. So those were those yets I had, because prison saved me from that, you know. But my brothers, they were there, my sisters, my mom, they all died behind alcohol, either through the disease, the physical problems that come with it, or through the violence that comes with it. I grew up, and that was normal, you know. My family drank. And they fought, and they hurt each other, and I thought that's the way it was supposed to be, you know. And, you know, one of my earliest memories was, I was probably around 5, and my mom used to go out and drink every night. But I would be at the house, usually alone, because my brothers and sisters found other places to hang out, and I'd be scared, you know. But I always knew that when she came home, if I was laying in her bed, she would pick me up and take me to my bed. And I would go to her bed and lay down because, you know, I used to love that smell. You know, she would come home and pick me up, and I could smell the alcohol on her breath with the spearmint gum. And man, that was like the greatest smell to me. You know, yeah. And but unfortunately, my mom couldn't really take care of us, and we ended up in foster homes. I mean, And when I was 13, I went back to live with her, and it was all cool, you know, because now I'm old enough that now when she's at the bar and it's a little, you know, getting real close to closing time, let's go get mom, go down and bring her home. And we were with her for about a year, and she was killed leaving the bar. A drunk driver hit her. And, you know, I found alcohol really helped with that pain of loss. You know, it just, you know, I didn't have to feel anything, and that was really good because I didn't want to feel anything. And I took that drinking, and it took me through the rest of my years in high school. I made two promises to my mom that I would finish school and I would go in the Marine Corps. I wanted to be a Marine since I was, like, you know, old enough to walk, I think. And I joined the Marine Corps, and you know, probably one of my proudest moments was walking in formation during graduation day, and, you know, and eyes right and general saluting us and all that. I thought I was King Kong. You know, if we have any fellow Marines in here, you know that feeling. You just think you'd cast me out. You know, and, you know, the unfortunate thing is that your Marines drink a lot. So my drinking took a whole new level, you know. I remember being on base and pulling mess duty. And if you ever pull mess duty, it's like a long day. You're in the mess hall at 3 a.m. and you don't leave until 7 p.m. But, you know, we're young, dumb Marines. We think we can do this and get off at 7 o'clock, go PT for an hour, run our 3 miles, and go back, clean up, and head for the E-Club, which is, you know, the military bar, and pound down pitchers of beer as many as we could before midnight because, you know, we had to go home and get at least a couple hours of sleep. And after a few days of this, I remember one time I was brushing my teeth and I can barely see in the mirror, and I'm just like, and God, man, you know, it was taking forever for the toothpaste to stop foaming, you know. I was like, what the? In a couple minutes, my taste buds started to come back alive. You know, I'm like, wow, this is weird. This tastes kind of like soap. So, you know, I look at my toothpaste. Oh, man, that's Prowl shampoo. Guess I should have got a clue then that, you know, I need to slow down, but I didn't. And as a result of my not slowing down, I ended up in numerous blackouts and committing numerous offenses, everything from fighting to just being a straight-up a-hole. You know, just, I don't know what it is about that firewater in this, but, man, we just go crazy. And, well, eventually it ended up in me going off base, committing numerous felonies, and going to prison. You know, Marine Corps had to let me go. He said, oh, well, you're on your way to prison. We can't wait for you, so you're discharged. So there went my career goals, because, you know, I was going to be like a lifer Marine, and too many John Wayne movies, I guess. You know, Sands of Iwo Jima, you know. But anyway, so my career path took a new a twist. You know, I started going on tours of the Department of Corrections. And it wasn't too bad. You know, I'm not as big as I am now, but, you know, I was a Marine, you know, and I was tough, and I've been fighting since I was like 6 years old. You know, I can handle myself. So, but, you know, I was scared to death. I remember that first night, you know, covering my head up in the blankets and crying, you know, because I was scared. And when I got to the place I was going to do my first term at, the brothers in there took me into the circle, and they kept me safe. and they took me to Sweat Lodge, and they gave me some direction that I really didn't have, and this sounds odd, but you know what they did? They gave me some direction, and I repaid that by acting stupid, you know. I was still young, and I was scared, and in order to master that fear, I had to become somebody that other people were afraid of, and it's amazing how well we can transform ourselves when given the right catalyst. And I you know, I was not a good person. You know, I did a lot of hurtful things to people. I hurt a lot of people, and I didn't have to be drunk to do it anymore, you know. And I just really, you know, it was all out of fear. And I came to these rooms because one of my counselors thought, maybe you should go to AA or whatever. You know, in San Diego, there was one of the pioneers in the Native Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Don, one of our elders that has since made his journey. And he took me to my first AA meeting at the Indian Human Resource Center in San Diego in 1987. And I thought, these guys are messed up, man. I don't belong yet. I didn't go back for another, almost 20 years, you know. Then I got those piece of papers from the judge, you know, it says, you got to get these signed. So I went to another AA meeting in the 90s, and I thought, well, I have to be here. Doesn't mean I have to listen. So I had headphones on, and I had a book. I'm going to kill an hour, get my court slip signed. Because, you know, you had the people up there, you know, the secretary and the leader. And I thought that they were just watching me, and that if I left early, they were going to pick up the phone and call the judge. But I made it, you know, I did that, got my court slip signed. And what eventually got me in these rooms, you know, was my higher power. I think it was a parole agent. No, it was a probation officer at that time. And he said, have you ever gone to rehab? Because I picked up some other bad habits along the way. And I said, no. He goes, well, you know, you should consider that. So, you know, I discovered that, you know, if you go to rehab, they kind of like, you know, give you a little pat on the back. Okay, you know, he's trying. And so I would go in and out of rehab, you know, 30 days, 60 days. I look, see, I'm cured. I'm bad. I did 30 days. I'm good. Because I never had any intention of never ever drinking again. You guys got crazy, you know. But that was that. No, that just did not cross my mind of never ever taking a drink again. I just the thought of it made me want to take a drink. And the great thing about programs is, you know, there's girls there. So I went straight from step 1 to step 13. And, you know, it was a little rough the first couple of years, but, you know, it's worked out. I'm engaged to this wonderful woman that's in recovery with me. And after my last term, going back for, you know, some illegal substances, I came back and I went to the neighborhood where I used to frequent because there's this bar that's, you know, the owner knows me so I can get a tab and... You know, and I know everybody there usually, you know, and I felt real comfortable there. And so I head on back to the neighborhood, and I walk up to the bar, and it's awfully quiet for a Thursday evening. It's dark. I'm like, what's going on here? I was, man, they're closed. 7 o'clock Thursday night. Man, they should be jumping right about now, you know. I look in the window. There ain't no bar in there. There's nothing. They done picked up and left without me. Just like the Marine Corps. And no forwarding address. But you know what? The funniest thing happened at that moment because, you know, there's a bar the next block over. There's a liquor store up the street. And I have been in the rooms of AA just long enough where those cliches start sticking to you. You know, like one day at a time. Keep it simple, you know. And I thought, oh, my God, this is one of those moments of clarity things, you know, where What are you going to do now? Oh. Well, I didn't drink. You know, I went and got room, and, you know, the next day I picked up the phone and I called people in the program, and I started going back to the meetings. And it was really hard. It was really hard because I'm not used to being out in the world without drinking or other substances or just being a complete a-hole, you know. I didn't know how to interact with people out here. You know, in prison, I do well. You know, it's tough. And there were days when I felt like I was just going to crawl out of my skin. You know, those days are just, and you know, what I did was I went to meetings. Sometimes I'd start at 7:30, and there was a really cool meeting I used to love because it was like downtown San Diego, kind of ghetto, you know, and if you had like 3 days of sobriety, you were an old timer. I love that meeting because I'd go in there, I could just cuss and get crazy, and everybody would be like, yeah. You know. Talk about how much I hated my life. I hated everybody and just really angry. Well, you know, 7:30 I was at a meeting, 9:15 I was at a meeting, noon I was at a meeting, 5 o'clock I was at a meeting, 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night I would find another meeting. I was doing anywhere 3 to 5 meetings a day because it was that bad, you know. I needed to be someplace where I would be safe for just an hour, you know. I didn't always like what I heard. I didn't even listen really to what people said. And if you called on me, you were going to get, you know, a lot of spewing of anger and hatred and, oh, God, don't even talk about God, you know. Because, oh, I was really angry then and with God. But, you know, you guys kept letting me come back. My home group, the Downtown Discussion Group, San Diego, Saturday nights at 7:30. God, you know, those people, can't say enough about them because, you know, when I first went to that meeting before I decided to stay sober, you know, I was just there checking it out. And I got called on a share, and like my brother said here, you know, you get really emotional. You know, I don't know why. It's just, you know, because you don't have to hide. I just felt like I didn't have to hide, you know, who I really was. And that was, I was just scared, you know. I remember crying in that meeting. I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, this is crazy. This is terrible, you know, because I'm a Marine. I'm a convict. You know, I'm bad, you know. You know. What is this? And, you know, they welcomed me, and my sponsor accosted me after the meeting and says, oh, God, I love your show. I want to be your sponsor. Well, I'd been around the rooms long enough to say, oh, I think we're supposed to get one of those. So, all right, yeah, okay, cool. You can be my sponsor. And, you know, he would take me out to have coffee and cake, and I was like the weirdest experience for me, being there with these people that were sober, and they're like laughing and having a good time, and I just felt like, what do they want from me? This is so weird, you know. Because it was so, everything was just not normal to me. And I remember him, because I wasn't really interested in doing this step stuff. And, you know, and he says, well, why are you here? Are you here because you're an alcoholic? Or are you here because we let you stay? And that just really made me mad. I caught a resentment. I split, you know, because I was like, man, who is that guy? He said, AA police? But when I went back out, came back, and I came back to the rooms, I went back to the Downtown Discussion Group. There he was. And he held out his hand, and he says, welcome back. Welcome home. And, you know, I was still struggling with the whole just trying to feel comfortable in my skin. And I didn't want to know anything about steps because I was like astrophysics. That was for the advanced class. And they let me just hang out, and they let me get up there, and they let me rant and rave and let me cry when I needed to. And they gave me pats on the back because I needed those too. Because I couldn't tell myself I was this good guy, you know. I had all that garbage inside me that was there. And I didn't see what they saw. So when they would tell me, you're a good person, we love you, I really needed to hear that. Because I had spent so much of my life trying to be something else. I wanted people to be afraid of me. When you saw me on the sidewalk, you probably went across to the other side of the street. And they just kept loving me, you know. And I started working the steps with my sponsor, reluctantly. I thought I was going to go on like the one-year plan, you know, like one step a year. Step one, year two. And it kind of worked out that way because when I got to step three, I hit a wall. I was not going to get on my knees. I was not going to pray to God because, you know, I was very angry with God. And it just wasn't happening. You know, I'm just keeping it real, sponsor, you know. Just keeping it real. I don't like the guy. I'm not getting on my knees. Sorry. Well, funny thing happens after one of my sharings, his wife, God, I love her, she's so cool. She came up to me and she says, you know, I know exactly how you feel. And I look at this little lady and I thought, well, she's got to be kidding me. What do you mean you know how I feel? She goes, yeah, I was angry with God too. And she shared with me her experience. And when she told me her reasons why she was angry at God, I felt like, wow. I am like the biggest punk in the world because, you know, I thought I had reasons to be mad, you know, this poor woman. And she took me to my third step. I said my third step prayer with her because I believe she knew I was doing it to the best of my ability. And, you know, no lightning bolts on it. But you know what? It allowed me to move forward with the fourth and the fifth and keep going ahead and I've made my peace with my Creator. Yeah. I go to sweat. I have a talking circle I go to. You know, and I can cry and I can tell Grandfather I love him. And was that the bell? There it goes. I can think of all the blessings in my life. You know, I have a lot of blessings today. I was blessed with a really unique opportunity. My first year of sobriety, I had the opportunity to take care of one of my elders. World War II veteran, one of those guys they dropped into Normandy on D-Day. I had utmost admiration for him and his wife. And, you know, I worked for them as a maintenance and taking care of him. He got sick, and she asked me to be his care provider. And I thought, okay, cool, you know, I could do that because, you know, he's got that coming for me. Last time I got in trouble, they were at the courthouse, and they were speaking to the judge for me, saying, he's a good guy, he's got a job, you know. The judge still sent me to prison, but yeah. Hey. And so when he got sick, I took care of him. We brought him home from hospice, and he was just curled up. Wasn't moving on feeding tube, and I would get him up every day and bathe him and dress him and take him out and on the deck and give him coffee, and slowly and surely he came back to life. It was miraculous. He started eating and drinking and walking too much because, you know, he would take off. God, good thing she had alarms on those doors because you ever heard an alarm? Where's Jake? Got to chase him down the street. A year and a half, I took care of him. It was such a wonderful time. I'd wheel him around the neighborhood up and down these hills, and he just drive me crazy. He was just ornery at times. But you know what? I learned from that experience. I learned how to love my fellow man, a fellow human being, for no other reason is that what we're put here for, is to love one another. I took care of him every day. I wiped his bottom. I cleaned him. And when it was time for him to make his journey, a few days before he made that journey, he came out of one of his little nodding out, and he says, they're waiting for me. And I go, He says, I got to get on the train because, you know, that from his era, that's what they did. They rode trains. And he says, how much is a ticket? And I remember getting this lump in my throat and telling Yank, next time they come, you know, you just get on the train because you paid for that ticket a long time ago. And I got in the habit of every time I left, I would say, okay, Yank, I'm leaving. I'll see you in the morning. I love you. And I'll give him a little peck on the forehead. You know, God, you know,
this guy, this convict, Marines, the way they're crazy, stuff like that.
You know? And the morning, his wife called me and said, Yank's gone. She says, you want to see him? I said, yeah, absolutely. I zoomed over there. I didn't know what to expect or what I was going to do. But you know what? Nature took over, I guess you wouldn't call it that. I did what I did every day. I bathed him. I got him dressed in his nice clothes because he was going to take a trip. He loved getting dressed to go to the doctor because that was the only time I got to wear pants with zippers. The rest of the time it was sweat and pajamas. The easy thing. And I dressed him up in his really nice clothes that he liked. And when they came to pick him up because there were stairs, you know, the gurney wasn't going to fit. I said, you know, I got this. Okay. And I picked him up. And I carried him. It was so light. I carried him down the stairs. I remember crying so hard. I thought, you know. And what he gave me, he gave me a gift. He gave me an opportunity to grieve. Grieve for my mom. Grieve for myself. And that little boy that was scared all the time. That had to become somebody else in order to protect himself. And grieve all of us, you know, that, you know, my peoples, our native peoples, and people in the world that are suffering from this disease. And, you know, I took him down and said my goodbyes. And I did what I learned in these rooms. I ran to a meeting. I bolted out the door. I said, wife, I got to go. She said, okay. I got to go to a meeting. And I went and I told you guys, and you guys hugged me and got me to it, you know, because for the first time, like in like 3 years, I really wanted a drink. I didn't drink that day. And as things continue to go on, you know, I'm learning that, you know, I don't have to drink. You know, I remember early in my sobriety, I used to hate people say, well, you know, I have my best day sober is better than my worst day sober is better than my best day, you know, drinking. I thought, you got to be crazy. But today I understand what they mean. Because you know what, I could be going through hell today, but you know what, it's part of the process. You know, sadness is one of, you know, being sad, grieving, and all that stuff is part of being normal. You know, I didn't know how to be normal, so I can be normal today, and that's a good thing. And I think my 20 minutes is up, but I'm the timekeeper. But before I end, I just want to end with this because, you know, it's kind of funny, but it really paints a picture of how wonderful this program is, Alcoholics Anonymous. Yes, I'm native, and I walk the red road, and I go to the talking circle, and I go to sweat, but you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous is what brought me back to the point of being able to do those things. And I'm glad my sponsor let me hang out. I'm glad you guys let me hang out. Even though I was kind of a, you know what, sometimes. You guys just said, keep coming back. And I did. And my sponsor, Butch M., God, you know, he's, when he took me through the big book, we started on page one, like the first page, like blank page. I go, what? Like, you know, I thought we'd like go to this first steps and just move, you know. But no, we started this blank page because you know what? He taught me the principles, the whole thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, the copyright, you know, what's the copyright page? But he taught me how to admit, you know, how fragile, how wonderful this program is. It's so fragile, you know. But we're still here. And that is just miraculous to me because, you know what, when he took me through the beginnings and taught me and told me how it began and Bill W.'s story and all that, I just like, wow, this is some crazy stuff. And I didn't like him when I first met him because he's a cowboy. He wears a cowboy hat, boots. Come on, man. I'm a Redskin. What are you talking about, man? You want to be that guy? Going to be my sponsor? You got me twisted. But that's the wonderful thing about this program, you know? Those of us that would not normally mix, we become best of friends. We learn to love one another. And, you know, this is my first international convention, you know, and I'm just so thrilled to be here in the city of San Antonio, you know, and, you know, just so wonderful because, you know, we were walking by the Alamo yesterday. I was reading that plaque about the letter and you know what, I just almost lost it because, you know what, I can do that today. I can have feelings. I don't have to hide them. I'm going to shut up now because I think I have my 20 minutes, but thank you for letting me share.
Hi, everybody. My name's Karan, and I am an alcoholic. Truly grateful to be here. I'm bringing greetings from Area 57 in Oklahoma. How about those OU Sooners? I'm Comanche and I'm Oto, and I was really glad to be a little bit of French growing up. I used to like to tell people that. I was born in Arizona, and I started growing up in Ludwigsburg, Stuttgart, West Germany. My father was a lifer, and he was in the U.S. Army. And that's where I started my drinking career. I started drinking at the age of 4. And I couldn't read and write, so I couldn't tell you all what I was drinking. But I could tell you what color it was and what those different colors made me feel like. And I hid it from my family for all those years. By the time I was 12, I was a full-blown alcoholic. And the progression of my drinking just worsened after that. In high school, I started getting the DUIs. I got my first DUI when I was 17. I took 7 guys AWOL from the Indian school. And we went to our little mountain 15 miles north of town to go steal some soldiers' beer because we had no money. And I drove them down that mountain with no lights on, drunk. And my alcoholic told me, my lights are out. They can't see me. I drove all the way back to Lawton with the lights out on my car. And by the time I got back to Lawton, the police were chasing me. And those guys started jumping out my window. You know, one by one. By the time I got stopped, I was the only one in the car. The second DUI I got in a little town called Anadarko, Oklahoma. You know, I was kissing my boyfriend while I was driving drunk. Third DUI, I just got drunk and ran in the back of a police car. That one was a given. After that, I lost the ability to have DUIs. I just started drinking and passing out. The last trouble I got into, it was an APC, and I woke up handcuffed to an undersheriff in the county hospital with a 3.8 blood alcohol content. And I don't know how I survived it. It's just amazing. I was in jail on that cot giving my last foxhole prayer, which was my first spiritual experience. And I was on that cot and praying. And I said, oh, God, get me out of jail and I'll do anything you want me to do. I'll go to treatment. I'll go to counseling. And I'll even go to AA. So right when I said amen, there's a knock on the cell door and the guy says, Miss Yellowfish, your attorney's here. And he came in and said, your sister is going to bond you out of jail on some stipulations. I said, what are they? He said that you go to counseling, go to treatment, and you go to AA. And I said, where do I sign? I went to treatment, and my counselor looked like Sam Elliott. And I went every day. Early. Attorney told me he was going to plea bargain for me. And he said, wear something blue like you're going to church. Keep your head down, cross your legs, and don't speak unless you're spoken to. Okay? And the judge said, counselor, what about AA? And my attorney says, your honor, my client wants to go to AA once a day for a whole year. And I'm sitting there with my head down. I'm like, I didn't agree to that. He's a counselor. I only need her to go twice a week. Your honor, my client wants to go to AA once a day for a whole year. He said, Miss Yellowfish, is that true? And I picked my head up and I said, yes, your honor. That formed my foundation. And I too was like the other speakers, so shaking, so scared, so full of fear. And that page 52 describes what it used to be like. I was a prey to misery. I was depressed. I couldn't be of no service to anybody. I had problems with personal relationships. That's what I was like. They told me to go to AA, so I pick a day when I thought that everybody would be at church. So I did the drive-bys, and I found an AA group that only had 5 cars in the parking lot. I said, I'm going in. And I got in there. There was like 45 people in there. And I said, I'm safe. This guy's only calling on his friends. So I sat by the door and watched the clock. And he pointed me out. He said, let's hear from that little girl right there. And the minute I said, I'm Quran and I'm an alcoholic, and I started crying. You know, I cried for 18 months. I was a crybaby at my home group. And it just started my AA, my AA career. I was going to treatment, and the counselor told me, gave me a list of the AA groups and said, don't go to this one group. And I said, why? He said, because those people are crazy. And that became my home group for 10 years. I was crying so bad in that first meeting, this lady came up to me and said, I'm going to be your temporary sponsor. And, you know, I still have commitments, problems with commitments, and I just made her my full sponsor on my 11th year. I celebrated 13 years 3 days ago. My home group is Spirit Winds of Lawton, Oklahoma. And I had a Big Book Thumper sponsor. And we call it passing the baton. We're always listening to CDs. The CD we listened to coming down here was Joe and Charlie, Four Step, talking about sex inventories and fears lists. And that I happened to bring my Big Book with me, so I had a book study coming down. You know, they say, what length will you go to stay clean and sober? Well, I'm like the rest of y'all. I drove through a hurricane to get here. A year went by, and that attorney was going to take me back for a checkup. And I had a big, thick stack of papers of all the AA meetings I had gone to for that year. And I said, do you want a copy of these? He said, no, I just want to look in your eyes. Because they say they could tell if you're sober just by looking at you. And I said, what? You don't want a copy of all these papers, of all the meetings I went to? And he says, what'd you do? Go every day? I said, you told me to. He said, no, I only wanted you to go twice a week. But I'm grateful that man had tricked me. And what keeps me in AA right now is those old timers, because I want what they got. And they keep telling me, stay close. Stay close to your home group. Find the service work. Clean your house. Be honest. Work the steps. My sponsor was in name only. She was my phantom sponsor for many years. She used to drive this little bitty truck, and everywhere I went, I would see her, you know, at the stores, driving down the road. I even saw her at this garage sale 30 miles away. And I started getting paranoid that she was chasing me. So I finally told her, okay, I'll do that four step. She was a really sneaky sponsor. She had me making lists of this and that in early sobriety. And guess what? By the time I got to my four step, I had all the information there. I just had to put it in one central place. And I had to read it to her. And I was sitting there, of course, I was crying. And she was sitting there with this big, huge bowl of popcorn laughing. And I'm like, you know, I'm in pain here. This isn't funny. And she said, Karan, you know, sweetie, you have not done anything else the rest of us have done. So that was the first time that I felt part of anything. Service work. I was groomed early for service work. And that kept me busy. That I didn't have to go out and experiment anymore. I sponsored, I washed coffee cups, emptied ashtrays, I washed floors, I wiped smoke off the walls. You know, that first home group was holy ground to me. It got me sober. And it wasn't until the 10th year that I left that home group because I got toxic. It wasn't to AA, it was toxic to the clubhouse. You know, I was that spiritual popo. I was that call list police, and I did everything wrong that you could do in an AA group. But I had to branch out and go seek sobriety at a different level. What happened was I managed the only Native American halfway house in Oklahoma. And there's people that had completed the program, and they started relocating to the Lawton area, and they formed their own AA group, which is I'm part of, Spirit Winds, and they have even formed their own Native American rally, which is we're going to have it for the first year in November 12th and 13th at Quartz Lodge in Lone Wolf, Oklahoma. And that's just the God of my understanding helping me to help others. I do a lot of district work, and I have to stay committed. I have my AA sponsor, I have an Al-Anon sponsor, and I've got a service sponsor. And I've got a therapist, too. And believe me, I needed that last one so much, because AA couldn't do and fix everything for me. There were some things that AA couldn't help me with that I had to go get help for. So I'm grateful for all these people because, you know, they have taught me. I make mistakes, and I would just have to learn from the pain. I didn't realize that I was just so full of pain that I was looking for a relief. And I found it invariably in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going through the part of the big book called The Family Afterwards. So I've got a son that's in the program, two of the programs. And I've got another son that's thinking about it. And he made me a grandma at the age of 14. You know, my folks were full-blown alcoholics. And I had a childhood like this gentleman had just described. And, you know, my folks hooked up at Haskell College. And everybody that hooks up at Haskell and has kids, you know, they're rascals. So, you know, I'm the youngest rascal in my family, and it's just been so rewarding just staying sober. Now, I know my family and friends are grateful that I'm sober, because I wasn't a very nice drunk, and I wasn't a very successful drunk driver either, and I've learned a lot. I've gained a lot of friends. I finally created the fellowship that I was craving. And I know that in order for me to keep what I have to keep giving it back. Because that gift was so free. And I'm just grateful that people support me and, you know, tell me the truth. You know, I couldn't get this program unless I was honest. And I still want this program, even after all these years. I can't just get well. I don't get well overnight. And I'm just grateful to be trudging this road with all of you. I'm honored to be here and always say yes when I'm asked, because that's what I was taught. Because every time I step forward and step up, you know, I grow spiritually. And man, have I grown. But I'm just grateful to be here and be amongst you all. And, you know, hopefully we'll our paths will cross again. And I just wish everybody a happy recovery, that you could be happy, joyous, and free like me. And, you know, have a safe trip home. And that's all I have.